The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Wednesday, the 23rd of September, 2020. On the podcast today, Dan Betts, Chief Executive Officer of Hummingbird Resources, provides an operational update on their gold projects. Also on the podcast, John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talks about Battery Day, carbon zero targets, and the following companies: Hummingbird Resources, Anglo Asian Mining, Keffi Minerals, Shanta Gold, and Blue Jay Mining. And also, Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, covers this week's Bitcoin news and gives investment advice to his uncle. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 visions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a host of other content, something there by Cadence Minerals, something there by Equals Group, and also check out our COVID-19 index. Biggest riser today on that index is N4 Pharma, up 24%. To 6.35. In fact, we covered that on the podcast yesterday with Vadim. And the biggest fall of the day, GenDrive, down 9% to 126.5. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dan Betts, CEO of Hummingbird Resources. HUM is ticker there. Dan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
And you must be like, I mean, it's had a pullback of late, but the gold price is going in the right direction, isn't it? The trend is there, and gold bull markets go forever, don't they?
I'm pretty optimistic about the gold price at the moment. If you look at the bigger picture and all the money printing going on, I think gold's in a pretty stable place. Yeah. As you say, a bit of a pullback overnight, but I think it's probably healthy.
Yeah, well, I think I've seen quite a few people saying, oh, I'm going to get it back into this pullback, because a lot of people have missed out on it. So they're looking, so people are just buying the dips, you know, I think, on gold. Okay, listen, you've had some news out about the Dubai Gold project, and you've got lots of parts of the business now. So before we get into that bit of news, Dan, for people not familiar, just give them a summary as to what Hummingbird's all about, please.
So Hummingbird's a gold producer with a gold mine in Mali, doing circa 120,000 ounces a year from that mine, the Yamfalila mine. We're also developing a project in Guinea called the Karusa project, and then we have this joint venture project in Liberia called Dubi, which has news out this morning. So the idea is that within 18 months we're self-funded to be a 200,000 to 250,000 ounce a year producer. You know, possibly 2 years from now, depending on licensing and development of the Karusa project. But in pretty short order, we're self-funded to be in that position, which I think puts Hummingbird in a very strong position.
Yeah, yeah. Well, take us through this announcement there, the project financing, if you could, the details of this.
So what you're talking about, Justin, is the Liberian project, Dubi, yeah, where we've got a joint venture partner who announced this morning that they have raised the funds to satisfy the conditions to start their earning. We've been working with their team, who I'm very impressed with, Andrew Pedley and John Saunders, on the ground in Liberia, putting together their exploration plans. And now that they have the money, I'm very excited to see them develop on the platform that we created there in Liberia, which namely is a huge asset base with massive exploration potential. So I think within, you know, 12 to 18 months, they are going to produce a definitive feasibility study and, you know, fast track the exploration to showcase the amazing exploration potential there. So I think that project, which Hummingbird maintains a 51% interest in after they've satisfied the conditions, that project with a DFS at these gold prices, well, I think it will be a very healthy number. I mean, there's no point looking into crystal ball, and the exploration potential and drill data. I think I'm really happy how we've managed to sort of unlock some value there on a look-through basis and with a team that's definitely going to execute well. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Just take us through, you mentioned the target production there. Just take us through that again, if you could.
Right, so I was talking about Hummingbird, based on our Yamfalila mine and our Karusa mine that we're developing in Guinea. But I think if you look at Liberia as a standalone project, I think that Liberia will be producing circa 200 plus thousand ounces a year from that project alone. And as I say, Hummingbird will retain a 51% interest post this earning. So, yeah, as you say, Hummingbird, it has a number of strings to its bow at the moment.
Yeah. And of course, and is everything going as planned? Are you happy with production at the moment? I know previously you've had a few hiccups along the way, but is it running as smoothly as you could expect?
Oh, look, I think in the circumstances of the world at the moment, where everything is difficult, logistics, supply chain, movement of people, rotations, I'm really happy with the team, and operations are ongoing, and people are weathering the challenges admirably. And I think the gold price is obviously healthy. So I think by and large, I'm pretty happy. I mean, I'm sort of one of these CEOs who, I guess, I'm always looking at the risks and the problems, as well as the upside and the amazing future and the, you know, all the big numbers on the spreadsheet. You have to get there and you have to deliver every day. And there's always issues. I mean, there was a military coup in Mali within a month, you know, 4 weeks ago. And on the day, that hit all the producers in Mali hard in the market, but it seems to have been managed seamlessly and professionally. We've had no interruptions to our operations, and you know, maybe net on a longer term view, that will actually be a positive development. So yeah, all things considered, I'm very happy, Justin. It's a long way of saying that.
Yeah. Let me ask you, when you get the gold price rising like this, like for example, what happens is, you know, as you know, gold producers have to, when the gold price is going down, you have to become more efficient and more efficient. All of a sudden, some gold producers shut down because they can't, you know, produce at a certain level. But then when the gold price goes up, I mean, are you a bit more relaxed on costs, or do you try and be as efficient as possible? Because I know your all-in sustaining cost is below $1,000, isn't it, at the moment? Is that right?
I think people, it's easier to approve exploration budgets and things like that when you have a bit more money in the tin. I think that's sure. But I think actually, in terms of management, it should be the opposite. I think you should use the opportunity and the financial strength of the gold price to be disciplined in your cost base. And it's an opportunity to streamline your business and get things working smoothly, because you're doing it for the right reasons rather than just because you're under pressure and you haven't got the money. So, you know, that's the way we're looking at it at Hummingbird. Is it's an opportunity to streamline and refine the business. And obviously we're going from, you know, it's been 10 years of developments. We've gone from an explorer to a developer to a producer. And now we're going to a multi-asset producer with the Karusa project. Got the development project at Karusa before it's a producer. So in terms of systems development and procedures and the management style in Hummingbird, it's a constant evolution, and we're always working hard to streamline that, really.
Yeah. And I suppose in the back of your mind, there's always that thought that, you know, gold price has gotten down, and so you can't just relax and start spending more, because the gold price is at $2,000. Sooner or later, it will dip, and you have to be, you know, one of the most efficient. I mean, do you have that in your mind? You need to be one of the, you know, is it like a competitive field where you think we have to be one of the most efficient out there, really?
It is, because that's the way the market looks at it. But I think you just want to be as efficient as you can be. You can only control what you can control. And if you can build a business that's the lowest cost quartile producer, then you're going to be safe for longer than 75% of the field. I mean, So on that basis, yeah, it's competitive. But look, you can only do what you can do. I mean, your resource is your resource, and you're constrained by that to a degree.
Yeah.
So I think the challenge is just to be as an effective and as efficient company as you possibly can be.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Dan, as always, on the podcast, I'll highlight the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets. And to get on that list, of course, someone has to hit that follow button on your page, or quite a few people. So give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add Hummingbird to their watch list, please.
Well, today's news is an immediate catalyst, I think, for direct look through of value. Pasofino's list in Canada, and we maintain a 51% equivalent interest. So, you know, I think that's an immediate value add. I think Hummingbird is at a point where it will be net cash in Q4 of this year. And that rapid deleveraging has meant we're in a strong position. And I think that will give us strength. And I think the development of the Karusa project, being self-funded to 200 to or 250,000 ounces a year, is a very, very achievable goal and will put Hummingbird in a very different position on the not too long-term basis. So I think those are three pretty strong reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, I can't see gold dropping back a lot. People are buying the dip there. They're knowing that the monetary situation is happening, you know?
To give you, look, if we were to do 250,000 ounces at $1,000 ASIC, for simple maths, that's $250 million of project EBITDA. So even after exploration programs and sustaining capital, and if we had a little bit of debt, paying down the debt, you know, our market caps are £130 million, and we're talking about 18 months out. So, I think there's tremendous levers for value accretion here.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Dan, good to chat to you. Hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. Cheers. Thanks, Justin. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. John?
Yes, good. Thank you.
I've got to say, how did you celebrate Battery Day yesterday? Did you dress up as a battery, a Duracell or something, you know?
We all listen to Elon Musk and marvel at the amazing stuff that he's doing.
Yeah, I expect many of his fans to dress up as batteries, you know, just listening to his stuff. But to explain for people who missed an amazing event, what is Battery Day? Because he trailed it a bit, didn't he?
Battery Day, I mean, it's great marketing, as most of what he does is. And it's where he presents the company's ideas and vision to the world. And, you know, as an event, it's grown and grown because Tesla has become so important on the world stage and very important, certainly for us, in the materials and mining sector. You know, what he says and what he plans, it does affect a lot of different things. I mean, the sheer number of electric vehicles that he's looking to produce. He's looking to ramp up production to 20 million vehicles a year. And the number of batteries to go in there, they're huge numbers. I mean, they're numbers that you would not have even thought were remotely feasible 10 years ago. And here we are getting closer every year. So the stock price came back a bit, but then the NASDAQ tech stocks were being sold off anyway. But the targets are fantastic. They're looking at doing 20 gigawatt hours a year. And in fact, there was one number, 100 gigawatt hours of batteries by 2020. Now, it's difficult to understand those numbers, but you need a hell of a lot of batteries to go into these cars.
Yeah.
And the new batteries are stronger and better than the ones that they've had before. And he's looking, crucially, Elon Musk is looking to reduce the cost of a basic level Tesla to $25,000.
Yeah, I saw that. In about 3 years' time, $25,000, which is about 20 grand, or just below 20 grand. In fact, I spoke to a guy yesterday, he bought a Tesla, doing a school run, and one of the fathers there said bought a Tesla, and he said, it's amazing, you just buy it on your iPad. There's not much, not many options. I thought that's quite simple because people get option paralysis. If you have too many options, it confuses people, doesn't it? So he said, not many options. And basically, because we live on the South Coast, what you do then is you get your invoice and all that stuff and your number, and you go to the Southampton dock and you go to a container port pretty much. The guy there at the trailer, which is a mobile trailer, and you give him your details, and just because loads of Teslas there, you just pick one up and you drive her off, and you do the updates over the internet. It's nuts. He said it's a very efficient way of doing it, really, you know, rather than having these places where showrooms that cost lots of money everywhere, they just have a port, just pick it up from the port, you know.
Yeah, you know, he cuts out any unnecessary costs. I suspect as the company grows, it will take on the sort of the trappings of that are used by the other motor manufacturers, because there's
I don't know if he will though. I think he's a bit of a maverick. He tries not to do that, doesn't he? That's why he's won out, I suppose, and that's why he's left them all behind. That's why the market cap is a lot bigger than his and any other company. Do you know what? It's funny we talk of batteries. The whole theme. I know when I look on, it's often go to BlackRock sort of website, look at their ETFs, because they often got new ETFs, and they very much invest in mega trends, as they call it. And of course, battery is a mega trend. I don't know if you saw, I covered two stories this week on my morning podcast, a 60-second podcast with macro information, and they were both opposite sides of the same coin, pretty much. You've got Airbus mentioning they're going to release carbon zero hydrogen planes commercial by 2035. Seems like a way off, but it's a big, bold claim to make. And also, on the flip side of that coin, General Electric, who's one of the biggest makers of coal-fired power plants, they're going to exit the market and focus on greener alternatives. And I thought, wow, I know Nkondesi had to deal with those guys in Mozambique, I think it is, but I thought, well, they're going to take a hit. But that, to me, you could sort of see it coming. You know, and that kind of theme. When you're investing, you have to be aware of the macro themes, because when big money pulls out of certain areas, you know, share prices collapse on certain stocks related to that. And I think a lot of it's like that with oil at the moment. You know, so many big funds, investment, sovereign investment companies are pulling out of oil. And so you may be investing in a company you think is doing quite well, but yet it's not. It's lowly rated, or the valuation is low. And that's the reason, because no one are valuing oil anymore. But I see a difference with oil, because we can't just flip from oil. You know, we're going to use oil for a long time. And I think, as you know, with any resource like the oil commodity, when there's lack of investment, then you get lack of discovery, which then you get lack of supply, which means, you know, the price shoots up. So I think the oil price, sooner or later, I don't know how long it'll take, but I think it'll go through the roof in the next 3 or 4 years, because there's just lack of exploration, isn't there?
Well, the proportion of electric vehicles compared to diesel and gasoline cars in the world is still minute.
It's tiny, yeah.
And so, yes, I think you're right. I think oil prices are going to recover quite strongly as the global economy recovers. And there's a bit of a glut of oil at the moment, but I'm sure the world will work through that pretty quickly.
Yeah.
In fact, the very interesting news today is that China has pledged to be carbon neutral by 2060. So in 40 years' time, they will somehow have neutralized their carbon footprint, which of course is horrendous. And that means no more coal very little in the way of coal imports, I suspect. Huge amounts of wind farms and solar farms. They've got quite a lot of hydropower, which they've been building in recent years, but certainly they're ramping up on the offshore wind farm turbines and that sort of thing. And that means they're going to be, I mean, part of the strategy is to keep the steel producers busy. China has always wanted to have this enormous steel industry, and that's what it's got. But of course, it's an industry that needs to be fed with demand. So In the way that we've kept our domestic steel industry in the UK going by building aircraft carriers and building offshore wind farms, because wind farms have, the turbines have those huge legs which are all steel. So the Chinese are doing the same. So it helps the domestic industry, and it means you can get cost-effective carbon-neutral power, free carbon power. So you can see why governments are going that way. The great thing is that a lot of that steel needs to be hardened and strengthened, and that requires vanadium and other metals and manganese to go in there.
Yeah,
not to mention the turbines that require rare earth metals and various other bits and pieces. So these wind turbines, the offshore turbines, are very, very steel and metal intensive.
Yeah, well, do you know what? Even that goal, that I know it's 2060. Wow. Where are we now? What year are we in? 2020? That's another 40 years. God, if I'll still be here, John, I don't know if I'll be investing still. I'll be probably just sucking food through a straw. But that aim, because China's massive, like you said, the energy consumption there is huge. Even that aim to get there will mean, you know, like I said, a lot of money being pulled from what they traditionally do, you know, or invest in. So that's a big title. But emissions will peak before 2030, they say. That's huge for China to say that, isn't it, you know?
Well, the US doesn't have a pledge yet. The UK and Europe has a pledge to go to zero emissions by 2050. The thing about China is, if they set a target like this, you know there's a good chance that they're going to meet it, because if they don't, if they look like they're going to fail, heads will probably roll, quite literally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, literally. Okay, let's have some company news. What are you looking at, John? I just had Hummingbird Dan Betts on, but you know, there's a bit of news there, isn't there?
Yeah, Hummingbird, they put out a funding update on the Dugbe project. So they've got 10 million in equity to fund exploration there. And then, so they're owning a 49% stake in the project. So it's more grist to the mill, as they say. Completion of a DFS underway, and so there's the preliminary economic assessment is to be completed in the first half of sometime soon anyway. And they've got a resource estimate of 4.2 million ounces at 1.38 grams a ton, so that, you know, given today's gold prices, that looks pretty interesting.
Yeah, cool. Anything else happening?
Anglo-Asian Mining came out with their interims, looking good. First half production of 32,000 ounces. They're guiding for 75 to 80,000 ounces, so they're looking for a much stronger second half. But they're a company that are pretty good with their statements. All in sustaining costs at $743 an ounce.
That's good.
That's a bit higher than it was, but it's still a huge margin if you consider that the gold price is at $1,883 an ounce. So well over $1,000 of margin there. EBITDA of $21 million. So you know, nice. And dividends are likely to go up by about 30%.
Nice. I can't see gold. I think, like I said, the gold price has dipped a little bit, but I think people are going to be buying the dip, aren't they?
Probably, yes. I don't think there's a huge amount of downside from here. The gold price typically pulls back when the dollar strengthens, and we've seen some dollar strengthening in recent days. So I think that's largely what the move is. But in fact, there was a little bit of selling of gold ETFs, but I would emphasize only a little bit. So gold looks like it's pretty well set and possibly ready for another run on the upside.
Yeah, cool. Anything else happening, Jim?
Keffi Minerals, they delivered a preliminary economic assessment on their Hewa project. That's got $93 million of value. So that's looking nice. Good copper and zinc grades. So nice. Good to see things moving in the right direction at Keffi there.
Yeah, cool. Anything else?
Shanta, they're going to increase the plant capacity at Nuluweka by 14%, and that will accommodate. That means they can process more of slightly lower grade material. So they're extending the life of the resource. They can manage lower grade material. So it's just generally quite good news, but it's not brilliant news. It's not the world's greatest news for a mining company. It means they've got to run faster to produce the same amount of material. But it's definitely progress for the management.
Cool. And we've mentioned a few there, but any other company news, John?
Just a note out, not company news, but the ilmenite price has been rising. So this is good for Blue Jay and Base Resources. Ilmenite prices rose by another 4.3% last week. So that's another $10 a ton in effect. And what that reflects is that it's a tight market for titanium feedstock. Yeah. So what you use ilmenite and rutile to feed the converters that then produce titanium dioxide pigments that go into titanium and go into paint. And a lot of people have been at home painting their houses over the last 6 months. I think there's going to be a little bit more of that over the next few months, unfortunately, in the UK and probably elsewhere. Look, I think economies are going to carry on working through the coronavirus, but the UK government has advised that anyone who can work from home should work from home. So I think, yes, probably more people getting their paintbrushes and paint pots out.
Is it people doing their houses or extending them or moving? It looks like a lot of people want to move to us now. Surprise, surprise, out of the cities. But again, I just think that's maybe a short-term trend. You get people. The cities will always be popular. Like I said, if prices go down in the cities, people just buy places in the cities. Because I think 6 months? Do you reckon COVID will be over? Done?
Yes, I would have thought so, because the vaccine developments are coming along. thick and fast.
Yeah.
It will take time to roll those vaccines out. Yeah. But if you think about it, let's say you've got a couple and one part of the couple wants to live in the country and one wants to stay in town. Well, right now, I think the argument is to move out to the countryside. What's certainly going on is house sales rose by nearly 16% in August. Yeah. That was partially helped by the stamp duty holiday, but also by a lot of people wanting to just try and move to somewhere with a bit more space.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of that going. A lot of people looking around trying to say, well, how can we get more space? It's easy to do that if you move out of town and into the countryside.
Yeah, how do I get away from humans? That's what we want to do. I just want to get away from humans. I hate them. They're disgusting, you know, germ-spreading animals. And yeah.
And a lot of people are going to want to move to places where it's easier to get into work. So where you might not have, where you could cycle into the office or where you could just avoid using the tube. Sounds like the mainline trains are not too busy, but the underground network is still rather busy. And from what I hear, the weekends have been busier than the weekdays, which is interesting.
So
the shoppers are less worried about catching COVID. People should be worried because the long haul COVID sufferers, the impact's quite bad, so that there is perhaps longer term damage to the lungs and the heart. Nobody knows quite how long these effects will last, but some of them maybe for some considerable time. And we wrote about it in our morning note that in an Italian study, 87% of hospitalized patients had symptoms after 2 months. A British study had similar trends. A German study, including many patients who recovered at home, found that 78% had heart abnormalities after 2 to 3 months. So this is probably worse news than the fatality rate in many respects.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. John, thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak to you next week.
Look forward to it. Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman, and he is the crypto trader. There's a small "the" there, though. It's just in the C there, but he is the crypto trader.
He is the only one.
Yeah, that's it. Do you know what? How is it? What is it looking like at the moment? Is it sold off? Is it bouncing? Is it bullish? I haven't even looked at them, really, the Bitcoin price at the moment. What's going on there, Gabe? What's going on in the crypto world?
Well, in the crypto world, things have been dicey, but not too bad. Basically, what's happening, you remember I've talked about many times on this program, the symmetrical triangle that you can draw around the entirety of the bear market that started after the Bitcoin peak in late 2017. So, you know, all the price moves since then can all be put into this big symmetrical triangle, which traditionally and, you know, from experience tends to be a bullish formation. So the implication is that once it broke out of this symmetrical triangle, we'd be off to the moon once again. It would be a new bull market. Now, it did break out of that symmetrical triangle in July, and you'll remember I bought back around then, but then it didn't sort of take off in as excitable a way as I was hoping. So I sold again, took my profit, and decided to sit on my hands and wait. And so what's happened in the past week or two is that we've seen it sort of carry on moving sideways, sort of parallel-ish to that the resistance line of the symmetrical triangle. So basically what we've had this breakout back in July, and ever since then, really, we've just been sort of correcting a little bit, moving slowly downwards. And whilst that's not ideal, it's, I have to say, perfectly normal. It's kind of what tends to happen, really, isn't it? You'll recognize such charts from your long years of trading, I'm sure.
Yeah, but from Bitcoin, it just, you think it's going to a trend, and all of a sudden, there's one of these stupid days where it just drops by, 30% or something like that. What's going on there? It breaks that trend. And so you think,
this is why you have to look at it on the daily chart only. I mean,
I'm looking at it daily, but even
But what I mean is, you know, if you look at, if the longer the perspective you look at it on, the more the chart kind of makes sense and looks more like a normal chart. Whereas, you know, even if you zoom in a little bit, it starts looking like some, like crazy town, as you say, because the swings are so wild.
Yeah, and I only look at dailies. I mean, you know, I think with Bitcoin even sometimes, it's if you look at it on a weekly.
And
whenever it touches the 200 moving average on a weekly, it's worth a buy. Because it did it in December 2018, to touch that. It did it in March this year.
June 2019 was where it hit its sort of intermediate peak, sort of on the way down, and then, as you say,
yeah. But if you watch it, it's only touched 200 moving average those two times since. Well, going back, and I'm going back now. I can't see it. We've gone back to start pretty much, but it's only dipped twice. But when it's touched 200 on a weekly chart, this is, of course,
yeah.
It's worth.
What are you looking at? 200-day moving average,
which is so essentially, back the truck up, sell the house, you know, piling the Bitcoin if it hits 200-day, the 200, you know, moving average on a weekly chart, because then you're pretty much guaranteed. It'll, of course, it'll dip a bit further, but may get a spike down a couple of days, but that area is there. Don't buy until it hits that, then it'll go back up.
Well, it's way above the 200 days still now, isn't it? It's holding its own above there.
Yeah, that 200 on the weekly is about 6,600, well, 7,000. So if it dips down that again, and get in there. What are you saying? Before we came on, you said some company has put all their reserves into Bitcoin. Who is that?
Yeah, MicroStrategy. They're a US tech company, obviously, as you'd guess by the name, and they're quite a big one. They're a $1.5 billion company, so not, you know, one of the giants.
What are they called?
MicroStrategy. It's okay. All one word. And MicroStrategy, basically, the guy, founder of it and CEO, decided that he, as he put it, fell down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin, just spent months kind of watching videos about it and that kind of thing. I'm concerned, I haven't spoken to the guy personally, but I'm concerned that he has been reading primarily positive information about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm not sure he's heard any of the opposing arguments, because he decided to put the company's entire cash reserves of $400 million into Bitcoin.
When did you do that?
He did it, about a week ago. A few weeks ago. So he put it all into...
So surely that amount of buying from one, it would move the price a little, $400 million.
He did it very slowly. He was quite proud of this, that they did it sort of carefully and slowly in many, many small transactions. A total of more than 78,000 transactions in order to buy that Bitcoin. So he was very proud of the fact that he didn't manage to push the price up by doing all these tiny, tiny transactions instead. And of course, because the if you sort of have the wherewithal to do cheap transactions, as I expect he did, then you know, even doing that many needn't cost that much money. So he has bought all of that Bitcoin. He's got all the cash reserves of the company in Bitcoin, and he's very proud of this because he believes that it is a safer asset, a harder currency than either gold or the dollar, which obviously he's worried about the dollar being printed endlessly. And of course, as we know, the value of the dollar has been falling significantly over recent months. So he's got a case, but I would still argue that that's a pretty risky thing to do, putting all your cash reserves into Bitcoin, because as you said, it could rise or fall 30% in a day sometimes. And in fact, the price has fallen significantly since his most recent purchases of Bitcoin. And of course, now the share price of MicroStrategy seems to be reflecting the movements in the price of Bitcoin. So I don't know if his shareholders are going to thank him for that either.
No, exactly. It's MicroStrategy. What do they do?
They do, Glenn, quickly Google
business,
to remember exactly what they do.
Business
intelligence, mobile software, and cloud-based services. They're a well-respected company by all accounts.
Well, I think they've gone mad, haven't they? MicroStrategy is incorporated, kind of provides business intelligence. Maybe they are going to be a genius when it comes to it. Maybe it'll take off to 100,000 bucks a Bitcoin. They'll be laughing.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? If the price of Bitcoin, you know, goes up 10 times, which would not be unusual for Bitcoin, then suddenly he's a genius, and everybody will be saying he's a prophet. He saw it coming. He's a genius. But of course, he's basically taking a guess, a gamble, isn't he? If the price of Bitcoin doesn't rise, or indeed, say, halves, which would be, again, perfectly normal for Bitcoin, it could easily fall by, say, 75% and still then, you know, recover at some later date, maybe in years to come even, but he will have lost three quarters of the company's reserves in the meantime when valued against the dollar. And that will be considered, you know, a disaster. So yeah. It's always a tricky one, isn't it? Because as ever with, you know, whenever you read books about some business genius or some trading genius, more often than not, if you really get down to it, they just risked quite a lot, maybe even all their life savings and all their family's life savings, and it paid off and they were lucky. And so you get to read the book about what a genius they were, and it feels like it was almost destiny that they were going to become a genius. But of course, you don't read the 100 books that were never written about the similar men or women who did the same thing but failed because they were unlucky and it all went wrong, and so they never wrote books about it. Yeah, but, you know, those cases exist in large numbers.
Well, I understand if you have cash, right, then there's no point having cash. I understand that completely. I've had that issue, not the same bigger problem there, but when you have got a bit of cash in my portfolio, thinking, right, I don't want to sit on it for too long in cash. I like to have some cash if the market's been running. I did have, you know, I got into cash largely before the big sell-off happened. But then I found myself fingers itching, you wanted to buy something because you need to acquire assets, essentially. That's what you need to do, you know, appreciating assets. And that can be companies, of course, that generate cash. And even now, I've got a bit of cash, and then, do you know what, I don't know if I want to actually put the bit of cash in my portfolio into my portfolio, any more stocks. I may actually move house, upgrade. Because, you know, once you buy a house, you know, if you can buy a house and you're not going to mortgage or anything, buy a house, then you're not going to lose money on that. You know, you can just put the money into that house. You're not going to lose. Or thinking of having an extension at my house now. So I'm thinking, what should I have? Because what if I do with that money? That's, you know, to me, that's a solid asset in a house. And I can't see that depreciating anytime soon. It doesn't matter.
You can't see it depreciating because in our lifetimes, or in our adult lifetimes, it's rarely depreciated. But actually, it's funny you say that because my uncle, who's a lot older than me, we were just chatting about where he should put his money yesterday because he's worried about the rock bottom interest rates. He can't get any interest on his savings.
And Bitcoin, you said, did you? Bitcoin.
Well, okay. He was thinking of putting more of his money into buying a bigger house. And I said, well, yeah, I mean, you know, obviously in our adult lifetime, it has generally paid off, blah, blah, blah. But you would be putting all your eggs in one basket because you've already got a house, and then you would just be putting all your savings into this bigger house, so then all your money would be in
the housing market.
But he pointed out that I said, you know, obviously we're used to house prices going up, and he said, good point, because when he bought a house in 1991, his first ever house, the price collapsed shortly because he bought it in the middle of that housing recession.
Yeah, but that was largely
earlier, 1989.
Yeah, but hang on.
He didn't even break even for another 4 years.
I know, but hang on. If you're looking at what's happening right now, hard assets are where it's at. We've got low interest rates. That was back when sort of interest rates were probably 10% or 15% or something ridiculous.
Yeah,
and so people couldn't afford to get mortgages. At the moment, mortgages, you know, are easy to get pretty much. They're getting easier, and you know, you don't pay any interest on them. And so hard assets are going up. And because there's gold, you know, silver, commodities, all that stuff, even houses. Is it like the housing market is booming at the moment?
I agree with you, but
if he doesn't need the cash,
do you really want to put all your eggs in one basket?
Yeah, but
it's
safer than putting your eggs in a Bitcoin basket, isn't it? Or, you know, a basket full of Bitcoins.
Well, because it's good to diversify a bit, isn't it? Surely.
Well, no, if he wants a bigger house and he needs it and he's going to use it, I think, you know what?
He doesn't.
Okay,
yeah,
well,
he's on his own.
If he doesn't, right, don't bother doing that then. If he doesn't need the cash, though, you have got to think about what to do with the cash. it's a good problem to have, having too much cash, thinking, okay, where can I put this cash? I don't want to sit in this cash because it devalues. I think I did a study once on why invest, in a little video, and I said, if you had 40 grand in 1980, by 2015, or 2010 it was, sorry, 40 years, pretty much, and it was like, that 40 grand is now worth £10,000 if you've not done anything with it. So the buying power of that has gone down to £10,000. So you have to do something with it. And inflation runs historically from that date, those 40 years, at about 5% a year. And so if you're not earning more than 5% on your cash, it's being devalued, you know? And so what do you do? It's a problem of that. And that's why you see these, you know, massive institutions buying long dated treasury bills out for nothing, you know, nothing, yeah. No one's earned them because it's going up a tiny little bit. It's not being devalued a lot. So yeah, I know you got to devalue, but that guy there, like I said, he may have. I wouldn't advise him. Maybe put 100 million in, maybe 50 million. But I wouldn't put the entire lot into Bitcoin. You know, it's just I don't know. Do something else with it. Diversify a bit. Just about getting
exactly. Just have some in dollars, some in gold, some in Bitcoin. You know, if he wants to kind of.
But I would avoid dollars. I'd avoid dollars because it's like
he's an American company, so it kind of makes sense to have some in dollars.
Well, no, because it's not a value generating asset, is it? The value is depleting. It's dilating. So why would you want to put it in that? You want an asset that's value is going to go up. And so gold looks okay at the moment, and maybe Bitcoin, but I understand not having dollars. Waste of time.
But also the problem with putting, you know, if my uncle would have put all his money into one big property, then of course he still wouldn't be able to get an income from that unless he did equity release, which is not necessarily the best deal that you can possibly get.
How much money has he got? What are you talking about?
I'm not going to say. It's more, you know, that's his business, isn't it?
But we don't know your uncle is. But we didn't.
All right, well, it's just a bit, you know, it's a bit rude, isn't it?
Are you talking six figures, seven figures? What are you talking?
Six figures.
Okay.
Not seven figures.
You need an asset that generates value. That's all. So what are they? Look at what are they? Typically, what's the best, most consistent generating value assets out there? And property is not a bad call, you know?
Property is not a bad call to get, though, as I say, you wouldn't get an income unless either you were renting out the property or you did equity release or something of that nature.
But does he need which the cash? Actually
would, does he mind need you, that cash? Would just return you cash anyway, and then you'd have to put it in the bank. That isn't really income.
Is he just saying he doesn't want to put it in the bank? He's got the cash. He doesn't need it, is he? Or what? I mean,
he wants to, you know, he's been trying to live off the interest from the savings and he's been doing that for many years, but now he can't.
Does he not understand if you buy a property?
Yeah,
a property is quite an illiquid asset.
And yeah, exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. Exactly. It's not really the solution. What I suggested as a possibility.
I know what you should do.
Obviously, I'm not a financial advisor.
Listen. Oh, we should do this. Just tell him to the Vanguard Tracker. A Vanguard Tracker, which is what I've got, that returns about between. I said, around 8% is done over the last sort of 10 years per year. That's decent. And that's very liquid. You can sell. I mean, because it's a fund, it's not ETF. You sell, you get a couple of days later your cash. But I mean, that's quite liquid.
I don't reckon he'd do it. He's very, very cautious, you see, and he'd consider that gambling.
Because his
shares can go up and down.
If you read about Jack Bogle, though, and Vanguard, then I think you'd trust him because, you know, it's an amazing story how basically. He was shunned by all the hedge fund managers because he said, hedge fund managers are a rip-off. I can outperform you just doing a tracker fund over 10 years or 5 years, charging minimal fees and just tracking an index. And he did. And they started really saying to him, will you get lost? We're charging people any money doing this. Vanguard, in fact, a life strategy fund.
I mean, I agree. If my uncle was younger, I'd certainly be saying, you know, stocks and shares certainly be a part. He's retired, sort of retirement age. So, or over retirement age. So, you know, at that age, you tend to kind of cash in any, well, a lot of people cash in whatever stocks, shares, investments are in their pension, right, and they get an annuity or whatever instead, because you want security at that age. You don't want to be at the mercy of the stock market.
No, but listen, if you look at Vanguard's life strategy funds, right, they've got all different ranges. It's from cautious to moderate to aggressive. And so you've got sort of like 20% equity fund, which is only 20% equity, but it's 80% sort of bonds and all that stuff. And
then bonds, though, I mean, it just in themselves, like, you know, they're considered a safe asset, but as we know, because bonds are at all-time high price-wise, the possibility of a bond collapse is, you know, it gets larger and larger every day. We don't know when it would happen. It might not happen for another 10, 20 years or even longer, but it could happen at any time. And if it I just don't consider bonds
well,
a safe investment.
Well, there we go. Tend to go with, which is not really aggressive at all. They say it's aggressive, but I'm with a life strategy 100% equity fund, right? And basically, 100% equities, but it's so well diversified. It's phenomenal. It's got about 1,300 stocks in it. That includes, you know, the tech companies, the big companies over here. So if you look at the performance, I'm looking at the performance now, and from 2015 to 2016, it did 23%. To 16, 17, 18%. It's coming down, of course, the stock market's going down. 10%, though, in 2017, 18. It's 4.6%. 18 to 19, and even from 1st September to 2020, it's done 2%. So if you average all that out, the cumulative effect of that is still very impressive. Still, you know, a lot more than you get in the bank, and multiples of what you get in the bank. And it's pretty much, you know, you're buying that. You're buying entire developed world equity, basically the biggest companies in the world. You know, so
it's true. This should certainly be a part of a.
I'll send you the link, portfolio. And you can have a look through
that. One other possibility that I suggest, just because I'm conscious we're running short on time, I just want to mention the other thing I mentioned to him, apart from stocks and, you know, that kind of side of things, and having some in property and some in shares and all the rest of it, and still some in the bank. But I also suggested, I've mentioned them before on here, Zopa, or one of those kind of companies, the peer-to-peer lenders, because you get a higher interest rate. Now, you are taking risk, of course, because
it's not regulated, is it? Or you're not covered?
It is regulated, but you're not covered. Yeah. No, you're not covered for losses. Now, you know, they've been going a while now, which is why I kind of feel that it doesn't make it necessarily safe by any stretch of the imagination, because, you know, there could be a massive insolvency event at any time. But it's peer-to-peer lending where, you know, large amounts of people are lending to large amounts of other people without the bank in the middle. It's just like cutting out the intermediary, though obviously Zopa is still an intermediary of sorts, matching up borrowers and lenders. But you tend to get, or they're estimating at the moment, somewhere between 2.5% and I think 5.5% is their projected return for this coming year, and that's after all losses, i.e. after unpaid loans, you know, because they'll parcel out all these loans, they'll do tons of loans, and a certain small percentage of them in any one year will not be paid back by people. So they take into account those losses, and then you end up with several percent a year afterwards. Now, that's been the case for the past 10 to 15 years that they've been going. In fact, the rates of return were much higher before. Now they're somewhat lower because interest rates in general are lower, but they were sort of 6% or even more in some years. Now, they're projecting more around somewhere between 2.5% to 5.5%. Though, as you quite rightly point out, it's not covered. So there is always the possibility of a catastrophic loss of capital. So if you were to go down that route, if he were to go down that route, then again, it should just be a portion of his portfolio, not the whole bloody thing.
Yeah. Okay. This life strategy fund, it just show this to your uncle, right? In the last 5 years, cumulative sort of gain has been 70% or 69.84 since inception, 134%. I think that's 15 years. So showing that and a decent rate of return. And now, as we sell off, of course, it's probably better. I just pay into it every month and a little bit every month. But I mean, I know.
Is that a global fund or a UK?
You know, it's basically 20% America, pretty much 20% the UK, 20% ex UK and America and developed countries, and then 20% sort of growing, you know, sort of developing countries. So yeah, it's like 1,300 stocks in it. It's so diversified. But yet, that kind of return is decent. You know, like over, I don't know when inception was, since 2011, 23rd of June 2011, it's 134%. And that's like, you can't get better diversifiers than that. It's phenomenal. I'll send you a link. It's a good thing. I mean, if you've got spare cash, I mean, I suggest anyone who's just, they ask me, the friends of mine, who say, I'm new to investing, what do I do? And I'd say, listen, I start with funds. And I said, I'm invested in this fund. I can't advise it, but these are the returns. And this is what they've invested in, from, you know, Microsoft, Amazon, all those big companies as well, and all the big companies in the UK, and the big companies in Europe, big companies in Japan, and all that stuff. So, you know, it's quite safe, I think, you know, generally, if you're investing up a long term and drip feeding. And the charges are 0.22%. That's not even half of 1%.
That's what makes the real difference, isn't it? That's why Vanguard was so successful. Suddenly they dispensed with all those expensive charges from not just the actively managed funds, but the sort of attempts that had been made at passive funds before that. Generally, fees were much higher, and Vanguard just came in. Jack Bogle just said, no, you don't need to pay them fees. We're going to give you exposure to all the world's equities without just paying a tiny, tiny pittance, is a breath of fresh air, particularly when you consider we had that resurgence of hedge funds about, 15 years ago. Suddenly hedge funds were the thing. They were really popular, and they're all charging 2% management fee plus 20% of any profits that they made. And most of those hedge funds no longer exist. Most of them, you know, blew up, lost too much money.
Exactly. They're rip-offs. Marvellous, Glenn. Gotta go. And we'll speak you next week, yeah?
Okay.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Galliford Try Holdings, up 1.28% to 81.2. At four, 4D Pharma, up 6% to 164. At three, Integumin, up 4% to 50.5. And at two, Supply Acme Capital, down 6.5% to 0.57. And at one, Valrix, up 21% to 48.5. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Jangada Mines, Valor announcement. At four, Dev Clever Holdings, new appointment. At three, Escape Hunt, digital licensing partnership. At two, Live Company Group, first contract for Paddington Bear. And at one, Hummingbird Resources, Dubi Gold Project Financing. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.